Okay, good morning. We're going to learn about, in our class this morning, about how to, according to the halacha, have a proper Pesach Seder. We're not going to get so much into, the style, how to make the Haggadah interesting and that. That's another class we're doing in a couple weeks on a Tuesday night. We're focusing primarily, as it's a managing your mitzvahs class, is how to conduct the Seder in the halachically correct way that you fulfill all the mitzvahs properly of the Seder. That's our goal. And as I was preparing it last night, it's going to take longer than one session. Unfortunately, not everybody's going to be here for the whole session, but Leonard, you can get the web in Florida, right? You can get onto the web?
Yeah.
All right, so we'll probably have maybe one more class we'll do on Thursday night, and you can plug into that if we don't finish it all today. I could tell by how many pages I have to type that how long it's going to take. So after I've typed about 4 or 5 pages, we're not going to be able to cover more in one day. But we'll be on the website more, God willing. So the first thing we need is to prepare properly. That is a key. If you prepare the Seder properly, you're able to make sure that a lot of things happen. One of the most important things is you have to start the Seder on time. As we'll see shortly, that the proper time to start the Seder is at nightfall, which this year comes out to 8:48 p.m. So that's pretty late. That's pretty late, and therefore, it's Toronto time. Maybe on the East Coast, it'll be about maybe 20 minutes earlier. But that's late, so you don't want to start it any later than that. You can't start earlier, so when it's time to start, one should start and not start looking for things and preparing things. And people tell me stories there at homes, and that they're there, and it's another hour till the Seder starts. So it's very important to have things prepared, and there's all kinds of halachic problems that happen if you're not well prepared as well. Pass that down, please. So these are the list I've come up with. If you come up with anything I forgot, I'll be glad to add to the list. And these are things that should be done before Yom Tov, because once you do them on Yom Tov, for some of them there's halachic problems how to do it. You have to do it in other ways, and you can, God forbid, transgress the Yom Tov. So obviously, all the items of the Seder plate have to be prepared. The shank bone should be roasted. The eggs should be prepared. The vegetable for the karpa should be prepared. The lettuce or the romaine lettuce should be checked and prepared. We have to be very careful now. I don't think we're going to get products from Gush Katif this year, unfortunately. And that was the lettuce that was very well washed and cleaned and didn't need much inspection for insects. So we're not going to be getting that this year. So you're going to have to go to other sources. I'm sorry?
Pearls
in terms of leafy lettuce. So there are people who check it too. There might be private corporations that are doing it. So you have to be careful to get ones that are bug-free, or you have to do some inspection on your own. Listen, 20 years ago, we had to spend a couple hours. There was no such thing as Gush Katif, and you sat down and you cleaned the romaine lettuce, and you had to inspect it with, to the light, and it's a lot of work. It's a very important thing that you've got lettuce. So nowadays, the latest information from the COR is that the iceberg lettuce that has a kosher certification, they feel that it is bug free. But not other lettuces. So unless it's Bodeg brand, but I don't think they do fresh vegetables anyway. So there's not a lot of options this year in terms of getting moror that is insect-free if you're using lettuce. If you're going to use chopped horseradish, that's a different story. But using lettuce, there's not a lot of options this year. There's basically the iceberg lettuce that is checked with a Star K certification or other certifications like that, that would be fine. If you don't check them, then you're going to lose more than you gain at the Seder. Because if you eat the moror and there's insects in the moror, for every insect you eat, the Torah gives you five negative averos. So you lose more than you gain by eating more that's not checked.
I don't know if they're any good.
Okay, just pass them around. Yes, thank you. I'm sure they'll be fine. Yeah, so everyone take a Haggadah. We'll just...
We
need another handout? Okay, Baruch Hashem.
There's only four art scrolls.
All right, we'll work it out. How many of the other kind do we have?
One, two.
So it's maybe better to use the other kind. All right, that's good. Fine. Shkoyach.
Ignore what's written in it.
That's fine.
It was edited before we came on.
That's okay.
We haven't used it since I became
okay,
so
good.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's continue on the preparations here. The charoses should be ground or chopped. So all should be done before Yontif. Salt water should be prepared. The seals on the wine bottle should be opened. The matzah boxes should be opened. The table should be covered with a white tablecloth. You should have the most exquisite items of silver on your table. It should really look exceptionally fine. There used to be rabbis who would borrow beautiful, ornate utensils to put on their table, even though it wasn't theirs, so it would look beautiful. You should make sure that the seating arrangements are taken care of so when people come, they know exactly where they're sitting. You don't spend 15 minutes trying to figure out where people are going to sit. You have to bring pillows down for people to sit, to recline on. You have to make sure there's enough haggadahs for everybody. The wine glasses should be measured to make sure you've got glasses that will hold the proper amounts of wine that is necessary that we'll talk about. You can't just take any sized wine glass, and you want to have the right kind of wine glass. Saucers under the wine glass are going to be spilling wine out. You may want to have a chart for matzah and morer minimum requirements, as we've given out in the past, a little chart saying how much of an area has to be covered by to make matzah and morer, for those of you who aren't exactly sure how to do the measurements on your own. You know, I'm sure in Europe 100 years ago they didn't have any charts. You know, they could just feel it. It's like a woman who knows how to cook without using recipes. You know, our parents of blessed memory, they didn't know about recipes. They just knew how much flour, how much water. They had a feel for it, and they didn't have to be told anything. So, you know, people, there's some people have a feel. This is how much matzah you have to eat. But if not, there's nice ones laminated. You can get from bookstores, and you put the matzah on top, and you can see how much area has to be eaten, or more, and that makes it easier for some people. So you should have that all prepared. There should be a washing basin ready with water for hand washing. Prepare the Seder plate, the three matzahs. The wine should be poured into decanters if you have them to make it look nicer. You prepare nuts and treats and different candies for the children to keep their interest very high during the Seder. You prepare a cover or a towel for the afikomen. You got to put it somewhere. These are all these things that you don't want in the middle of the Seder. You know, you're putting away the afikomen. Oh, I don't have a towel. Okay, go run to the kitchen, get a towel. Oh, we don't have this. Go run to the thing. It breaks up the flow of the Seder. You want to have everything ready to go as because there's enough to concentrate to do a proper Seder. You have to make sure there's extra matzahs at the table because the three matzahs will definitely not be enough if you have any kind of a group. There should be extra morer in the fridge that's ready to go. That one little leaf on the car is not going to be enough for everybody. You don't want to keep it out on the table because by the time you're ready to do the morer, it will all be dried out, so you've got to keep it in the fridge. The men should wear a kittel. At least the master of the household who runs the Seder should have a kittel. And some say all men who are married should have a kittel at the Seder. This is it's an important thing, and it should be done. The kittel is there to remind us of a lot of things. Number one, first of all, we're doing a service. We're doing a service to God this night. It's a very special service. And the Kohanim, when they did their service, they dressed in white. Well, they served in the Beis HaMikdash. Also, white is a symbol of purity. It's a day where we can reach tremendous levels of tshuva on the Seder night. And the most important lesson is that it is, as we know, whenever we wear a kittel is a time to remind us of tshuva. We wear a kittel. Men wear a kittel on Yom Kippur. Man wears a kittel on his wedding day. A man wears kittel for his final journey to the world beyond. And you wear a kittel on Pesach. So all of these, what do they have in common? They're all times for teshuva, where you get closest to God. And the kittel is symbolic of being close to God because it has no pockets. It's not ostentatious. There's very little of you manifesting through that kittel, but more surrendering to God. So that's why the kittel is extremely important. And the fact that one knows that one day one will wear a kittel for the final time of his life. And when one is in the next world, he will not be in a position to do any more mitzvahs. And therefore, it's a good reminder to the master of the household that, you know, you've got children at this Seder, and you better make sure that there's someone who's going to take over the Seder when you're not around anymore. And you have to make sure that when you're in heaven, and there's no way you can improve your spiritual lot once you're up in heaven, the only way it can be improved is if your children follow a path of Torah mitzvahs. And the Seder night is the most fantastic opportunity to encourage children to be those kinds of people that you want them to be. So therefore, wearing the kittel kind of says, you know, you can't dilly-dally around. Don't squander the opportunity of the Seder. Take full advantage of the Seder, because one day you won't be around to teach your children, and now's the time to do it, and don't wait till later. So that's a very important message that the kittel brings to people. And certainly as well, we should have our nicest clothing. Women should be wearing their jewelry. And it is definitely should have a festive nature of genuine holiday spirit is around the Seder table. And it should be, you know, dealt with more so than in any other way you make things elegant in your life. That's for the Seder. And that has to be, you know, whatever preparations people make for weddings and bar mitzvahs and simchas and this and that, this should be more. Not that I'm suggesting that the amount that we do for simchas now is perhaps, it could be a bit too much, but certainly the Seder should be no less than any simcha that you make, because it's much more joyous. It's much more joyous, because at this meal, God is sitting down and he's dining with you. All right, or better yet, you're dining with him. That's what the Zohar says. Your mom is sitting at the table with God on the Seder night. It's a tremendously, powerfully, beautiful, giving time. And therefore, one has to recognize it as such. So one isn't getting the fancy linens and the fancy silver for his own pleasure, but rather to give honor to God who's coming to the table. So that's an important thing to think about. And all these prayers, you need a lot of time. Erev Pesach is generally not a day to go to work, just because there's so much to do to prepare for the Seder. So therefore, when you get the preparations, if the preparations are done properly, you've already accomplished half the goal. Then it'll be a lot easier to get through the Haggadah. I didn't put one other thing. It should have been that the master of the Seder, the leader of the Seder, should prepare the Haggadah thoroughly. You should go through the Haggadah, go through all the points of the Haggadah, prepare the messages you want to tell your children or your guests, and, you know, not go on the fly. So that's all gets things ready to go to begin the Seder. Okay, now the Seder plate itself, there are six items that are put on the Seder plate. And, you know, a lot of times most people buy Seder plates. You don't have to buy a Seder plate. You can use a regular plate, believe it or not. Use a regular dinner plate, as long as you put the things in the right place. And you should know, not every Seder plate you buy, these artistically done Seder plates are not necessarily all halachically correct in terms of where they tell you where to put things. And therefore, you know, they'll tell you to put the egg in the middle or this and that, and it's not right. You can still use that, just don't follow their guidelines. You know, where they say egg, you might put the mor instead. So you got to be careful when you're buying a Seder plate. It fits. I've seen Seder plates that are just not done correctly. So, and we follow the custom of the Arizal, and if you look on the way I put the words at the bottom of the page, you see on the upper right hand side, we put a piece of meat, a piece of roasted meat, either a shank bone, or if you're using poultry, a wing or a neck, because we are told that God took us out with a zeroa netuya, with an outstretched arm, so to speak, a zeroa. And this item is called the zeroa. We have a piece of roasted meat to remember the fact that when we had a temple, if we were with a temple now, we would be eating roasted meat as the Paschal offering. So that reminds us that there was a Paschal offering that we're supposed to have. You will not eat that roasted meat at the Seder. That piece on the plate, You will not eat it. You can eat it on the second day of Yom Tov afterwards, but you don't eat it now. On the left side is the egg, which reminds us of the Korban Chagiga, the Paschal, the Yom Tov offering. When we had a temple, you would always bring at least two offerings for Pesach. At least. There's other things, but one was the festive offering, that's called the Korban Chagiga, and then the Paschal offering. You'd have two of them. So there was definitely a carnivorous event. There was a lot of meat eaten in the times of the Beis HaMikdash. And that egg, since, you know, it reminds us that there was another offering that was built, that was done. And we'll talk later, you know, why we have a custom of eating eggs. And this egg can be taken off the Seder plate at the Seder to be eaten. And the custom is to roast the egg. If you can't roast the egg, you boil the egg. And the custom is to leave it in its shell and not to peel it. In the middle, you got one of the two species of Moror. And on the right side, lower right side, you got the Charoses. That's all the apples and cinnamon and nuts and wine. It's all chopped up and put together to remind us of the mud that was used to make the bricks. On the left side is the Karpas, a vegetable that's a non-Moror type of vegetable. And then below, another type of Moror. And the two most common types of Moror, we said, is a lettuce and the horseradish, the grated horseradish. So that's the way the Seder plate should be lined up. Turning the page. The matzahs. You have to have three matzahs. Now, where do you put the matzahs? See, if you have those multi-purpose Seder plates, if you have a friend who got you a nice gift, that's the best kind, if you can get it, where they've got a Seder plate on the top, and it's suspended on a little three-tiered contraption, where there's three levels where you can put your matzahs right in there. There's all kinds. But that's great. It's an all-in-one thing. You just bring this big round item. You sit it down on the table. You got the Seder plate on the top. And then underneath, you got three levels. You put the three matzahs in there. And you get a nice little cover that goes around it. And you can just move the hook. And you have to uncover the matzahs. Just move that little cover around. So there's different ways of... you'll just find them in Judaica stores. That's a very handy thing to have. If you want to give someone a nice gift, that's a nice gift. Usually people wouldn't buy that for themselves, but it's a very nice gift if you're going to someone's home, if they're hosting you for the Seder. And if you don't have that, then you put the matzahs on a plate right next to the Seder plate. You have your Seder plate in front of you and your matzah plate in front of you, and that's fine as well. And only the head of the household is required to have this Seder plate. If you want to make the other guests feel important, you'll give them also a Seder plate. It could be logistically, it might work out better if you have a large group. To wait for one person to give it all out could take a long time. So you might want to have two or three heads of households so each one takes care of their family. So it just lets the Seder go by quicker. Not that we're in a hurry to finish the Seder, but the key element is not to waste time during the Seder. There's so much to do during the Seder. You don't want to waste time with technical things that you could have, if you would have thought in advance a little bit more, those things would go much quicker because there's enough to do without the technical things that get in your way. Okay, so now we're just about ready to start the Seder. But before we start with Kiddush, the custom is that the father blesses his children just like he blesses them on Friday nights. The priestly blessing is done as well. Because again, it's a very auspicious time of divine giving, the Seder night. Very auspicious. And the opportunities for blessings are great. So one should spend time blessing their children before they begin the Haggadah.
Is it possible for the mother at any time to bless the children?
Okay, the custom is that the father blesses the children. That's the way the custom has been. We're not going to tell women that they're not allowed to bless their children if they want to. But it's not brought down in any Jewish sources that I'm aware of that the mother blesses the children. It's generally the patriarchal duty of the father to do that. Some Sephardim have a custom that the children, after the father bless them, they go over to the mother and kiss her hand. Yeah, so that's a very nice custom. Certainly it's not going to hurt if the mother gives a blessing, but that's not the custom. Now, women are obligated in all the mitzvahs of the Seder. They're the exact same as men in this area. even though some of these mitzvahs are time-bound mitzvahs, which generally women are freed from. But since they were included in the miraculous Exodus, so they have to celebrate as well. And everything they do, the only thing that they don't need to do is the aspect of reclining. There's an aspect to recline to show one's freedom and one's sovereignty. And we recline at different parts of the Seder. Again, the custom is women not to recline, because it's women are more tzniastic than men. Women are more, they comport themselves a little bit differently than men, and when it could tend to sometimes be for men, it could be seen as a little bit provocative, even though a woman's not intending on that. But when a woman's reclining back, it's a lot different. It gives off a different aura. Not that the woman is intending on doing it, but then when men are reclining, and it's just a question of tznius, if one is sensitive to those ideas. You know, however, they should still sit in very comfortable chairs. They should be in the most comfortable chair they can find. But and if they want to recline, they may. They're not forbidden from reclining. The custom has been that women don't recline. And children from the ages of 5 or 6 should be trained already that they should recline, to get used to that fact. How do you recline exactly? So it's much better to have armchairs for this. If you have an armchair, it's very easy. You put your pillow on the left armchair, and you just put your hand like this, and you're reclining. And that's a very comfortable position to be in as you're reclining on your left side. If you don't have an armchair, it's more challenging. So if you have a lot of room on the table, just put the pillow on the table, and you recline like this, you know. If you don't have that, then, you know, you have to find a way to put, you know, either put a chair next to you, and put the pillow there, and just, you know, go like that. I mean, the days of the Talmud, they really reclined. I mean, they used to have, you know, love seat style chairs, where your mamish could, the chair was like 3 times as wide as this chair, and you could mamish just, you know, just right there. Lie like this, you know, and be very comfortable, propped up, and you're lying like this during the Seder. And that is certainly the way that kings comport themselves, and that's the concept. So you have all kinds, and certainly if you were at certain Sephardic Seders, you know, that was done Bedouin style, you know, you're sitting on the floor, on pillows on the floor, so it's much easier just, you know, to recline on the floor like that. It's much easier. We did that last year for one of the Seders, and everybody was quite comfortable, maybe too comfortable. But so definitely that should be happening at certain parts of the Seder. Okay, we're ready now to begin the actual Seder and the laws that are involved in the Seder. So it might be good if you just took any Haggadah that you see. You know, and we'll just... again, I can't... We're going to have different Haggadahs, so I'm going to assume that we all can find the page. For Kaddish, we begin Kaddish, and in this Haggadah is on page 20, and your Haggadahs might be on page 4 or 6, depending on which Haggadah you have. Try 20, see where that takes you for that big Haggadah. So we begin, it's customary, some places, they begin by listing all the 15 steps of the Haggadah, and there's a song that's sung, Kadesh Urchatz Karpas Yachatz. It's a very old, time-honored traditional tune to sing the 15 steps of the Seder a couple times to get people into the mood. Okay, now the actual Kiddush, as I said, should be made as soon as it is nightfall. And again, they said this year it's 8:48. You can be lenient and maybe start a little earlier at 8:40, a more lenient opinion, but you should not make Kiddush earlier than that time. If you're living in Toronto, 8:40 is Toronto time, Thornhill time. Should not be making Kiddush before that time. Now remember what I mean by Kiddush, it's Kiddush. You could already by 8:30 start sitting down at the table, pour the wine, sing Kadesh Urchatz, could do all those preliminaries, bench the children, all those things you could do before 8:40 and get ready. But the actual Kiddush, that's the real essential beginning of the Seder. So that cannot begin before 8:40 p.m. The earliest, and 8:48 would be more optimal. And again, the reason being is because the holy energies of Pesach don't begin until it's nightfall. For example, you know, and I appreciate the challenges that people have. They have relatives and friends who want to have an earlier Seder. Let's say they want to have a Seder at 7 o'clock. You know, maybe 6 o'clock. So the problem is, you make Kiddush, eat matzah, and all these things before 8:48. You did a lot of nice things, but you didn't do one mitzvah because you didn't do it at the right time. It's like keeping Shabbos on Wednesday. If I keep Shabbos on Wednesday, I haven't kept Shabbos. I can do everything. I'm Amish. I go to shul. Nobody's there. I go to shul. I come home. I sing Shalom Aleichem. This, that. I do everything. Soup, nuts, and say Shabbos davening, everything. But you haven't kept Shabbos. So the same thing. Even though Pesach is 2 hours away, the holy energies that are coming into the world are not there. They're just not there. And therefore what you do, the miraculous nature of your mitzvah activities. One of the greatest miracles of existence is that when you will chew that matzah, you will bring more faith into your soul. The matzah is called the main menusa. It's the bread of faith. You eat matzah, you have more faith. You do these mitzvahs, you do the mitzvahs properly, you will gain freedom. Right? And that's a divine gift that comes to you. It only comes to you when you do it at the time that God says to do it. You do it earlier, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. You haven't found the right time. No matter how inspired you might have the most inspiring Seder, the singing was great, and everybody felt something, but what they felt was an aberration of spirituality, but not real spirituality. And the spiritual benefits you certainly didn't get. So that's why it's critical to make sure that you don't begin before that time. Again, if you have, personal shalom bias issues, contact your local rabbi for practical suggestions how to deal with that. Okay? But that's critical. But as well, you want to make sure you don't start any later than 8:48, because then it's getting late and the kids are anxious. And it's asking too much for them as well. You have to always remember, everything has to be age appropriate for the age shul that you have, and you have to make the proper preparations. I would hasten to add, we should probably have added on the beginning of the Seder preparations, one of them is very important, is a good nap in the afternoon. A good, 2-3 hour nap would be amazing. If you could, get that like from 4 to 7, that would be an amazing thing to do. And then you could, it would be very easy to stay up that night and get all the children and no one's going to school the next day, right? So the whole idea being you put them to bed and you say, if you want to stay up for the Seder, you have to go to bed. If you don't go to bed, if you're not going to take a nap now, then you can't stay up for the Seder. A lot of people, they insist on having little kids stay up at the Seder and they're cranky and they're irritable and they destroy the whole Seder. And there's no mitzvah. There's no mitzvah to bring them to the Seder if they're that cranky. And so what you have to do is you have to prepare well in advance again. And that keeps it proper. But still, start when it's the time to start. Fine.
If you start later than 8:40, say 15 minutes later,
it's okay.
You're still performing the mitzvah.
You're certainly performing the mitzvah. I'm just saying, you want to, there's another concept. People who love to do mitzvahs do them with alacrity and do them as soon as they can do the mitzvah. So if 8:48 is the soonest you can do the mitzvah, do it then. Right? Okay, I'm not saying if circumstances, the guests haven't come yet. Okay, you're not going to start the Seder without the guests. Right? But if you're all around, everybody's there, there's nothing to wait. Get on with it. Start the Seder because you're going to have to eat the afikoman. It's going to have to be eaten by a certain time frame. And you're going to, a lot of times before you realize it, that you say, where's the time gone? And you wish you had those 20 minutes earlier that you didn't waste, because then you're running into problems, that you're not eating the afikoman at the right time. So that's why you want to start as much to on time. No, don't be neurotic about it. But generally, the way we make sure, we have designed that the husbands come home a couple minutes right before the time. Everything should be ready, and then you're ready to go. Now, when you're making kiddush, as we have on page 20, number one, the matzah should be covered. And the rule of thumb is that the matzahs generally are uncovered the entire Seder, except for the times when you are holding the wine. When wine is being held, So in deference to the matzah, the matzah bread is usually a more significant food item than wine, and therefore we cover the matzah. So the rule is, whenever you're picking up a cup of wine, you're covering the matzahs. Otherwise, the matzahs are revealed. Okay. Now, the custom, again, to show that everybody is a king, is, and especially the leader of the Seder, should not pour his own cup of wine, but someone else should pour for him. And the extended custom is that nobody pours their own cup of wine, and everybody pours for somebody else. Everybody treats everybody else at the layer like a king. And that's a nice custom to have. Who says the Kiddush? Different customs again. And again, and whenever I say there's different customs, what everybody do is fine. One is that the leader of the Seder says the Kiddush, and everybody else listens. The other custom is that each head of the household recites his own Kiddush separately, and the family members listen. And the final custom is everyone says the Kiddush together, including the women and children. So it's either everybody or one person at a time. You can't have, what you can't do is two people at the same time and other people listening. The reason for that is we have a rule in the Talmud, two voices cannot be heard. If two people are talking, you're not hearing any one person. And when the person is making Kiddush, he has to discharge your obligation. He discharges his obligation when you hear him. Hearing a chorus is not hearing one person making the bracha. So you don't want all the head of the households together saying the Kiddush for everybody, because now we're not hearing one voice. You could have the head of the household say it separately, one after another. Or you have everybody say it together. Now if everybody say it together, it means the wife has to be able to say it, the kids have to be able to say it. If you know your wife or kids or husband, whatever the case is, doesn't know how to say the Kiddush, then one person should be saying the Kiddush for everybody else. Okay? Now, since this isn't just regular Kiddush, but this is also the first of the four cups of wine, so all the participants should have their own cup of wine. See, it's a good time of seeing all the typos over here. Should have their own cup of wine and hold it during the Kiddush, whether they're listening to the Kiddush or reciting the Kiddush. Everybody should pick a cup up when the Kiddush is being said. Everybody, because that is the first of the four cups of wine. What kind of wine should you use? Preferable to use red wine. Red wine is generally associated with a better quality, generally. It's also, red is the color of Pesach. It's the color of Pesach because of all the blood that was spilled to the Jews, the plague of blood. There was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears for the Jewish people till they finally got out of Egypt. So it reminds us of that. Remember the Medrash of thousands and thousands of children were killed every day so Paro could take a bath in the blood of Jewish children. So there was a lot of significance to the color red. And now we're using the red in a positive way. However, if the wine you have, the white wine, is of a better quality, you really like this white wine and you don't have a red wine that you like, then you can use a white wine. That's fine. But then it's preferable to mix a little red wine into it so it at least looks red. But a little red wine and white wine already has a rosé color. And when you're doing that, you should be pouring the red wine first and then the white wine in afterwards. So you don't see the difference in color taking place when you're doing that on Yom Tov. Now, if you want, you can use sparkling wine. That's also good as long as it tastes like wine. And if you can't tolerate even the lowest amount of wine, then you can use grape juice. Now, again, I would recommend that when you get wine, nowadays it's possible to get wine with the lowest alcohol content. Because you're going to be drinking four cups of wine, and you want to have your mind fully, all your faculties ready with you. So they make wine now that's like 5% alcohol, and that's a good number to take as opposed to the 12%, 13%. So it's much less, makes an impact on your mental facilities. So that's, and you could check, they got lots like that. So it's not a law, I'm just telling you that's a good idea to do that. And certainly if you can't drink wine, you could drink grape juice. They now even sell wines that are half wine, half grape juice. I got last year something called Efrat Kal. It's called Light Efrat. So it was like only 3% alcohol. So So in other words, they diluted the wine with grape juice. So you should check that out before Pesach and find something that is really low in that alcohol content. I've been at many seders where people got very, very tizzy, dizzy, and just, you know, were just out of it for the seder, because we'll see in a minute, they took large cups and they drank. If you drink two large cups of wine and you put in 13, 14 ounces of wine, that's 13% alcohol, many women, you know, all of a sudden the room is spinning and they're out for the count, and even guys. So you have to really be careful when you're doing that, because you won't be able to do the other mitzvahs properly. Which leads us to the next point, is how large must the Kiddush cup be? So the Kiddush cup must contain what is halachically called a reviz. That in plain old English terms is the minimum amount for a yunt of Kiddush is the Kiddush cup should hold 3 ounces of wine. That's all you need. If it's a Friday night where there's a biblical command, okay, 4.5 ounces. But on a Thursday night, on a Wednesday night, Thursday night this year, 3 ounces is sufficient. Now that's a very important point. Okay, there's more stringent. The most stringent is, let's say, 5, 5.5. That's the most stringent. But Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was a great, great rabbi, he said 2.9 ounces, so 3 ounces. And you're going to wonder, so this is a very important point that I'm trying to say over here. Because a lot of times, you know, you go to homes, they got these gorgeous, gorgeous crystal glasses that must hold, you know, like 9 to 10 ounces. And they serve, put wine in that. We're going to see in a minute, a person should drink a majority of the cup, if at all possible. So that's a lot of wine. Now you can get glasses that are 3 ounces. Nice looking glasses that are 3 ounces. And that would be the way to go. If it's not a Friday night, even 4.5 ounces. And you gotta measure. This has been done before Pesach. It's very simple. Just get a measuring cup. Measure the measuring cup to 3 or 4.5 ounces of water. Pour it into a Kiddush cup, see if it holds it. But you gotta do that before Pesach, and you know, it's not the time an hour before Pesach to start running buying Kiddush cups. So, you check it out, and I have like one Kiddush cup that is mamish, it's a very small Kiddush cup, and it holds 4.5 ounces, and it's a machaya, when you only have to drink that, but when you know, a lot of the regular Kiddush cups, regular Kiddush cup, you know, it's a good 8, 9, 10 ounces, and that's a lot of wine for some people. So if you go with a low alcohol wine of, let's say, 5%, and it's only a 3 ounce cup, that's not so much alcohol going into the system, and you just go right on with the Seder. So that is something to be cautious about when you're preparing. Yes?
Do the wine glasses have to be dedicated only for Passover?
No, the wine glasses do not have to be dedicated for Passover. It could be any glass. Technically, it could be any glass.
But the plates and cutlery must be.
Plates. Again, there's two different questions that I think I'm hearing from you. Number one, the fact that I use it for mundane use, does it allow me to use it for the Seder? And B, is it chametz stick? Can I use it for the Seder? So there's two questions I'm hearing. I'm not sure which one you meant, but I'll answer both. So you could use any stuff you use during the week, during the year, but you'd have to kosher some of them. Right? So glass, you'd have to kosher the glass. And there's a way to kosher the glass. For Pesach. If you're using silver, you should kosher the silver. If you use it a whole year long for chametz, you could use it for Pesach. Come to our Tuesday night koshering the house for kitchen class, and we'll tell you exactly how to kosher all those things you need. You can use almost anything you use during the year for Pesach, almost, as long as you kosher them. So the same thing with Kiddush cups and all those things, you could use what you use during the year, but you'd have to kosher it and make sure it's... And it's not a big deal. A silver Kiddush cup, all you're doing is put it in boiling water, and that's it. So that's not a big deal.
If Pesach falls on the Shabbos, would you go for the 4.5?
If it's Shabbos, if it's Friday night, you must go at 4.5 for at least the first cup. For the first cup.
So the first night Pesach, even though it's biblical, the wine's only rabbinical, am I right?
No, Kiddush is, right. In other words, Kiddush is biblical on Shabbos. Right, and that responsibility, and therefore we go to a larger amount for the kezayis. In other words, there's a machlokas, there's an argument, how large is a reviz of wine? There's different opinions. So when it's a biblical question, we always go a little more strict. When it's rabbinic, we go less. So the 4 cups of wine is rabbinic. Kiddush on Shabbos is biblical. So therefore, when it's Friday night, I have to go with a bigger amount to be safe. But under regular times, I can go with a less amount. Okay, now, when reciting the Kiddush, it's good to know what you're saying. But if you don't know what you're saying, at least have in mind that you want to fulfill two mitzvahs. The mitzvah of making Kiddush, and the mitzvah of drinking the first of the four cups of wine. I have in mind to fulfill that mitzvah. And when you're saying the Shehecheyanu blessing, you should have in mind that that Shehecheyanu that God has brought us to this time is applying to the holiday that we're coming to and all the mitzvahs that we're doing this night that we haven't done a whole year. That's what you have in mind for that. Ideally, one should drink the entire cup. And that's why we're saying a small cup is a good thing to have. We're on the third page now. And if that's not possible, it's sufficient to drink a majority of the cup. So
what
now,
that's
freedom. A free person drinks.
No, but I mean, what's the idea? You know, the minimum you have to have is 3 ounces, 3.5 ounces, 4.5. But if you've got a cup of 8 ounces, like, why?
Because it shows that, you know, when you have a cup, you drink most of the cup. I'm drinking up the cup. A free man drinks the whole cup.
Because most people that drink wine never put up a cup.
You know, what can I tell you? You know what? People don't know how to be, how to act royally. I am sure if you go to the Queen's dinner, I am sure they fill the glass with wine. I would bet they fill the glass with wine. I would be sure. They don't take a big glass and just put a little at the bottom. I mean, you know, when you're a king, you don't scrimp. You know, you're a king, give you a little 2 ounces on the bottom. I'm the king, give me a full glass. Right? Now, we're not gluttons, so we don't go for 15-ounce glasses. We go for a proper amount. It's the concept of King David says, my cup runneth over. Right? My cup runneth over. So you want to have a full cup. All my blessings, they're full. Right? So I have full blessings, and I want to partake of that full blessing, and I want to drink the whole cup. Okay, at least the majority of the cup. Right? So therefore, now if that's not, so you should try this. So therefore it's better to get a small cup that has 3 ounces so you can drink the whole cup than to get a 9 ounce cup and even if you're drinking 5 ounces. Because it's better, it's a greater showing of freedom that I drink the whole cup. That's a sense of freedom. That cup is symbolizing the blessings of your life. It's the blessings of my life. And God wants to give you a full cup of blessings, and he wants you to enjoy that full cup of blessing. So you symbolically play it out by having a full cup, and you drink the full cup. If you're not drinking the full cup, there's something's the matter. What's wrong? Why aren't you drinking? Why aren't you taking in all the blessings? Right? So that there's a lot of symbolism there. And therefore, you know, that's where the rabbis, I've said this in the past, the rabbis said, you know, this is the smallest amount. And they're suggesting you need not have such a big cup.
And if you drink more than the 3 ounces?
You can drink more if you have a good constitution and you want to, you know, you can drink and drink and drink and you have a nice big 10-ounce cup and you drink the whole thing for the sake of heaven. And it's only because you love Hashem and all those things.
You'll wait for the other 3 cups.
You can do that, but you know, it's not recommended. You can, but it's not recommended. And therefore you don't want to go for these big glasses. It's a problem. Mm. And you're going to have to drink a majority of that cup. So you should have to spend a little time before Yontif buying the right kind. You're better off buying a simple cup than an ornate Kiddush cup that's so huge that you're going to have to drink so much. Now, of course, you should try to buy an ornate small cup, and you can get those kinds. You go around, you'll find these nice little wine glasses, small wine glasses, 3, 4.5 ounces, and that's the right kind to use, and that should be recommended. But you should be drinking at least the majority of the cup. Now, again, if you're having trouble with that, then you go switch into the grape juice zone. You see, in the grape juice zone makes it able to do that. But it's better to drink wine, right? It's better to drink wine, and therefore go for a cup that's exactly the right amount so you could drink the wine the way it should be.
What about plastic?
Plastic is, you know, would be bidyeved after the fact, okay? It's not the best initially. I know they sell nice little plastic Kiddush cups. It, you know, again, there's pragmatics in your life. If you've got 50 people at your Seder table, okay, I would understand why you don't want to buy 50 silver Kiddush cups. Okay, that could get a little expensive. So, you know, you want to buy a nice, plastic kind of cup. Okay, you know, if you have a lot of people, okay, there's practicalities involved. Certainly the person making the Kiddush should have a nice Kiddush cup. Certainly all the heads of households should have a nice Kiddush cup. But you're right, if you have tons of people, okay, you have to be practical also. You have to be, just like, you know, you should serve your finest china. Yeah, but if you have 40 people with a Seder, I don't have a service for 40. Right? Okay, so we're gonna go with paper plates. Okay, so you get nice paper plates for the Seder. Okay, I mean, I know in Europe our parents would never have done this. Never used paper plates. First of all, I don't think they had. And even when our parents lived after the war, they said, oh, I'm gonna have paper plates. But then again, they didn't have 40 people at their Seders either. But what?
Everyone
uses paper plates.
Fancy.
But it depends on people at the Seder. If you only have 8 people at the Seder, you have a service for 8, and then it's not a problem, service of 12. But if you have, we usually have big Seders, so then you have to go, you know, paper cups and paper things.
So I don't understand why your guests have to have a Kiddush cup. They can use a regular glass, whatever, as long as it has...
But as long as it's a glass, as opposed to, it's better of a glass, but again, you don't want to give them the drinking glass that they normally have, because those drinking glasses hold, you know, 12 ounces. So if you have a regular, real glass made out of glass as opposed to plastic, that's preferred. It's preferred to give them a real glass. That's the preferred thing to do. So, and plastic and those other things, you know, if you have a lot of people, then you use it if you have to use them. Now, when you're drinking the cup, ideally you should drink it without pausing. If that's not possible, you pause a little bit in between. And if that's not possible, the longest it should take is 4 minutes. If you're taking more than 4 minutes, it's not considered one drinking. At this time, when you finish making the blessing, you recline on the left side while drinking the wine. And that's true even if you're a lefty. You still have to recline on the left side. And you recline. If you did not recline for this cup, you're not required to drink it again. But for the second cup, you will be. So
the left side, Rabbi.
The left side for two reasons. Number one, a practical reason is most people are righties.
Right.
So if I'm leaning on the left side, I got my right hand to give me the cup. If I'm going to lean on my right side, it's going to be very hard to drink that cup.
Okay.
But for that matter, you'd say, okay, so if I'm a lefty, I should switch it. To which we then say, though, that the esophagus... and the, I don't know what the other one's called, trachea, right? So when you're drinking the wine, you don't want the trachea to get to the wine instead of the esophagus, right? So that's the right one, right? You don't want the windpipe before the food pipe. So when you lean on the left, the food pipe is closer and that wine will go in the food pipe as opposed to the windpipe. So that doesn't matter if you're lefty or righty, everybody's windpipe and food pipe are the same. So therefore the lefty, so it's a health precaution as well. Health precaution as well. Now, you may, after that first cup, if you're thirsty, it's going to be a long way to go till the second cup for some people. It could be an hour, two, three of Magid. So, and you're singing and your throat's parched. You can drink in between the two cups, but not alcoholic beverages. Don't drink more wine because we have 4 cups of wine. We don't want you sneaking in a few more cups, you know, during that goddess. So it looks like it's 5 cups of wine, 6 cups of wine. You take whatever, some water, some juice, something like that, is fine, to keep your mouth, from getting too dry, but not wine. Okay, that is Kaddish. Urchatz. Now we wash our hands. You wash your hands exactly how you wash your hands for bread, where you're washing the right hand 2 times to the wrist and the left hand 2 times to the wrist. However, you do not make a blessing. No blessing is made over here. Because
after you've washed, like your
daim. Yeah, Al Natilas Yadayim is not made. There's no blessing Al Natilas Yadayim made. This washing is a symbolic washing. It's not a halachically required washing. That's why there's no blessing. It's a symbolic washing. What are we symbolizing? A number of things. Number one, in the times of the temple, where we had much higher standards of purity and impurity, when a Jew ate a fruit or vegetable that was moist, he was required to wash his hands. That was when we lived with higher standards of purity. People went to the mikvah all the time. We don't have those higher standards because of the Beis HaMikdash, all kinds of things. We don't have the Beis HaMikdash, but we want to remember that there was a Beis HaMikdash. So, and since we're going to, in the next step, take the karpas and dip it in water, if we lived in the temple, we'd be required to wash our hands. So we do it as a remembrance for that, A. B, when the priests would start their service in the temple, they would wash their hands. And we are now really beginning the real service of the Haggadah. So we wash our hands for that as well. So this is not a halakhically required washing. It's a customly required washing. Therefore, there's no blessing. And since we're free men, I want to give that impression. So the leader of the household, and for that matter, anyone else, the mother, they don't leave their seats. And the children dutifully go to the kitchen, bring a big bowl and with a big cup, and the father sits at his place, he sticks his hands out, and they wash his hands for him. Or he give him, maybe they don't have good aim, to give him the cup, but he doesn't leave his seat, he washes, they bring him the towel, that's royalty. And that's an important thing, kids should learn that that's what they have to do. And you can have a nice bowl, so it's just water goes right into the bowl, pass it around to whoever of the adults, whatever, how you work that out. The kids have to go a few times to the kitchen to do that. That's a very beautiful custom. You have to be careful not to speak after you wash your hands until we eat the karpas, so you'd keep your focus to the mitzvah of karpas, which is the next part of the Seder. Which is karpas. Eating the vegetable. So now what is karpas? Karpas is a vegetable that's preferably eaten raw. The most commonly used vegetable is celery. That's the most common karpas that you'll find. Although, a sweet radish, cabbage, parsley is also very acceptable karpas. Nothing wrong with that as well. Some people will use a potato, but it's got to be baked. But that's not the most optimal. Again, why a lot of homes use potatoes. Got to remember, in Eastern Europe, there wasn't a lot of vegetables. Remember, it's April now. Mm. You're in Poland in April. Where are you going to find a head of lettuce? Mm. I mean, it ain't grown lettuce, as far as I know, right? It ain't grown in Poland in April. So we get lettuce. I don't know. Larry, where do we get lettuce now in the winter? Where's it coming from?
California and Florida.
All right. So I don't think in Poland in the 1900s, they were shipping lettuce to them. Right? Now remember, the Haggadah was written when we lived where? In Israel. Or in Iraq. So, okay, you know, I'm sure there's lettuce growers during that time of the year. That's where you get lettuce. Then they went up in Poland, so what are you going to do? I don't have any lettuce. I don't have any parsley, none of these things. But potatoes, there are lots of potatoes in Poland. So then they use potatoes. So you can appreciate, in Poland they use potatoes. And that's what you'll see in my house. My grandfather's house used potatoes. All right? But it wasn't the optimal. It was all they had. You know, people get offended. You know, use potatoes. What are you doing? What are you coming with celery for? Never heard of such a thing. He didn't hear such a thing because he couldn't get celery. But that was the optimal vegetable. You want a vegetable that can be eaten raw. And a potato doesn't fit in that category. So we were stuck. There was nothing else. So the rabbi's going to do, okay, use a potato. It also grows in the ground. So, but therefore, we don't want to make Shalom Bayis problems. If you have grandparents who like potatoes, give them potatoes. Then don't make any problems. But a celery would be a lot easier. Got to make sure, though, with these items, again, inspect, there's no insects. You gotta wash them and make sure that they're proper. You should not, though, use lettuce at this point in the game, because lettuce is one of the materials used for morer. And we don't want to confuse karpas with morer. Karpas is one mitzvah, morer is a separate mitzvah, so you have to make sure to not use what's going to become a morer down the line. Now, one of the symbolisms of the karpas, I mean, there's all kinds of symbolisms in terms of the gematrias and the numerical values. The Hebrew word karpas has a samach at the end. That's the letter 60. That stands for 60 myriads of Jewish people, 60,000, 600,000 Jewish men. The first three letters of karpas backwards spell perach, which is hard work. So it reminds us that 600,000 people did hard work who came out of Egypt. We dip it in the salt water, which reminds us of the tears of the Jewish people. You know, and why specifically a vegetable like this? So the symbolism is, you know, these things grow in the ground. Growing the ground is not exactly, when you look at God's beautiful world, like we talked about on Tu B'Shvat, you know, we understand fruits are like the most unique of God's things that grow in this world. Apple, orange, you know, those are, taste great, they're beautiful, they're clean, they're sweet, you don't have to bend down to get them. That's the optimal fruit. So you'd figure, why don't we have an orange at the Seder? But the answer is, we're trying to teach a lesson. We're taking specifically vegetables that grow in the ground. They're dirty, they're filthy, they're so low. And what do? We say, you little low celery stalk. You little low radish. You've been buried under the ground. But now, when it comes time for redemption, everything gets redeemed. And we could take this lowly celery and put it right up at the Seder table. Symbolism is very great here. You know, a Jew could think he's very low. What am I already? What am I? I'm a nothing. I'm from the ground. I'm from the gutter. Right? A person could say that to himself and say, no such thing. You know, man is compared to the tree of the forest, the tree of the field. There's sophisticated trees and there's not such sophisticated trees. If you're a tzaddik, you know, you're like a beautiful date palm tree. A tzaddik is compared to a date palm. It grows big and it's got dates and it's got shade. It's got all these kinds of things. Ooh, he's a tzaddik. And then you got Jews, unfortunately, who they're little radishes. These radishes are just stuck in the ground. And it's, who am I to come to the Seder? So we say, no, you little radish, we want you at the Seder too. We want you at the Seder too. Also, this dipping something in reminds us of the first time in history there was dipping. When was the first time in Jewish history was a note of dipping done? Anybody know? In the Chumash, first time you came across something being dipped. What? When Abraham has tests? No. Guests? No. No dipping. They may have dipped, but it doesn't say they dipped. Very famous dipping. You should have this in mind. The first dipping of the Torah was when the brothers took Joseph's coat of many colors off and sold him into slavery. They dipped the coat into blood to make it look like a wild animal ate him. And that was a dipping that was symbolic of disunity and acrimony between brothers. When we come to the Seder, we want to do a tikkun, a correction for that dipping. And to show that we're all unified. And this is a dipping that's a dipping for a mitzvah. Okay, so that's another thing we have in mind. Now, you have to, when you eat this, and I know there's some people who are a bit hungry at this point in the game. As a matter of fact, it's past 8:48 by now. It's probably getting to be 9:15. And people are hungry. No matter how hungry you are, you can only have a very small amount of this karpas. Less than 30 cc's, which is not a lot. It's a kazayas. Less than a kazayas. So that would be, it's a small amount. It's a small amount. If you figure the minimum amount of morer are stalks of morer taking up this little block 3x5, that's a kazayas. So you'd have to eat less than that.
So minimum wise,
you can't just a little bit. So you got a little bit. Give a one bite. There's no minimum. The minimum is you're tasting something. But you got to be careful. Some of our homies want to have like 5-6 pieces of celery. Can't do that because that would require an after blessing, and there's all kinds of logistics that I'm not going to get into, and that's not allowed. It's not allowed. It's not time to feast up on the karpas. Just a little bit, and the karpas should be held in your fingers, not with a fork, because the whole reason we're washing is because when you eat something that's wet with your hands, you have to wash your hands. If you're going to use a fork, you've defeated the purpose of that. Okay, everybody makes a blessing on this. Since it comes to the ground, you make the blessing Bore Pri Ha'adama, and you have the morer that you will eat later, which also comes to the ground. You'll have that in mind with this bracha now, and you will not make another bracha on the morer later. Now, you're not obliged to recline when eating the karpas. If you want to, you can. And the prevalent custom is to eat it without reclining. But if you want to recline, you can recline. What do you do with the rest of the karpas? You can get it off the table if you want. Some have accustomed to leave the one piece of karpas on the Seder plate. The salt can be removed, although some will leave it because they're going to have eggs with salt later on. But it doesn't have to stay. Okay, moving on. Yachatz. We break the middle matzah into two uneven pieces. You've got to make sure it's uneven pieces. You know, it's probably the one time of the year Murphy's Law goes against you. So you got to make sure you place the thumbs to the side where you have an uneven piece. Now, you got to be careful with a few things over here, and we'll explain what you have to be careful about. The smaller piece, that is returned back to the Seder plate, and you got a broken Seder of matzah in between the two matzahs. The larger one is wrapped up in a cloth. Now they have fancy afikoman bags nowadays. And if you have children in school, what kid doesn't come home with a pillowcased afikoman bag? And of course you use that to make them feel good, right? The problem with some of those is they make them very small. You know, I've had different kids in different years. You know, you keep it from every, I've got afikoman bags from 20 years ago. I like Mayor Zalman's first afikoman bag, you know. So, you know, you can tell which teachers are a little more sensitive to halacha or not, because you're putting in a fairly big piece of matzah there. You know, one year I had an afikoman bag that, you know, was like smaller than this. I couldn't fit the matzah in. You know, you need a nice sized afikoman bag. And that larger is put away. Again, there's different customs. Simple custom is the father puts it, let's say, behind the pillow, puts under the table. If the father wants to keep the kids even further up, what he'll do is he will hide that afikoman himself. So then the kids are going to have to look for it. It's customary, I forgot to put this in, it's customary to take the bigger piece that's in that little bag, whatever, and walk around, put it on your shoulder, and walk around the table. Because that's what the Jewish people did when they left Egypt. They loved the mitzvah. They carried the matzahs themselves and didn't put it on the donkeys. So you might want to symbolically show this is how the Jewish people went out of Egypt with the matzah. And then if you want, you're already doing that. Then if you're the head of the household, you go up to upstairs and you hide it. And there'll be a time when the children's interest wanes. And then you say, okay, and you hide in a good place. So it takes them along. Gets them excited. It wakes them up. I'm not saying you have to do that. For some, if you just put it behind your place and they hide it, that alone will keep them up. So it's your options, how you want to work that. Now, we break the bigger piece and put it away because Pesach is a day where we remember the fact that we were slaves and that we are also remembering that we are free people. And a lot of people, you know, that's what happened on the Seder night. We transitioned from being slaves to free people. Therefore, a lot of things we do remind us of being slaves. A lot of things we do remind us to be free people. And what you're really trying to do is that until the first half of the Seder, you remember you were a slave. And the second half of the Seder, you're acting more like a free person. You're trying to relive that transition yourself. So one of the things a poor person does, poor person gets a piece of matzah. One thing he does not do is eat all the matzah up in that one shot because he doesn't know if he's going to get matzah tomorrow. So what do? You eat a little for now and hoard and save more for later. And that's what the poor person does. We take the big piece of matzah, put it away. Who knows what's going to be for tomorrow? It's also a very beautiful symbolism that I heard is that we know that that matzah, we know that there was, when was the first time in Jewish history was anything divided in two?
During the Midbar, when they were giving shekels for the building of the Mishkan.
All right, during the Midbar, did shekels, did a half shekel coin, but they didn't divide it in two. That shekel was a complete half shekel. When was something divided in two?
What about the seas?
The seas split in two? There was something before that. You're right, but there was something before that. That's, some suggest that's a symbolism for the three matzahs. We break the middle matzah because it's symbolic of, let's say, breaking the sea. You had the banks on one side, the banks on the other, and the water split in the middle. So we break the middle matzah. But there's something that came before that, Leonard. And, oh, that's a good one, but that wasn't where Adam made the split. It happened to him. The first time a person split anything was Yaakov. When he was afraid that Esav was going to destroy him, he split his camp up in two. He split his camp up in two. And he said like this. He said, well, splitting my camp up in two, lest Esav come and destroy one camp, the other one will escape. And Yaakov had a very deep symbolism in that. And what he was saying was, every Jew has two parts. Has a body and has a soul. The body, the non-Jews can destroy. But our soul, we don't want them ever to do that. See, what can Arafat and what can Hussein and all these PLO people, what can they destroy? They can destroy the physical Jew. What could Hitler destroy? He could destroy the physical Jew. And Yaakov was saying that no matter what, even if Esav will destroy the physical entity, the Jewish people, I will break in half and acknowledge that there's a second half of me, a greater part of me that is my soul. And that soul can never be touched. And that's really what's happening in the Seder here. You see, what ultimately the Seder is supposed to provide for us, if we do the Seder correctly, and we have the right intentions, is that God will reveal aspects of our soul on the Seder night that we aren't aware of a whole year long. That's what God's prepared to give you as a gift this night. You're going to have feelings of closeness to Hashem you never felt before. So what you do is you break the matzah in half. And the smaller half, the less significant part of ourselves, that we put on the Seder table. That we tell the story of the Haggadah. We talk about how the Egyptians took our bodies and they beat our bodies and they killed us and the blood was flowing. And they made our lives miserable. And you're right, that smaller part of the Jew, that which you can see that's on the table, that the non-Jew could control, God forbid. But the greater part of myself, the part that's hidden, my neshama, that the non-Jew can never touch. Unless I let him. The only one who's going to destroy my neshama is me. But if I don't, and I keep my neshama, it stays intact. So as we go through the Seder, as we say, oh, I look at the tragedies of this and that, those aspects of redemption or slavery that was physical, that's how we tell the story. But then the greater part of me is my neshama. And then when do we bring it out? We bring it out at the end of the Seder. At the end of the Seder, which the end of the Seder is symbolic of the redemption and Mashiach, at that time, everyone will be able to get in touch with his neshama. So that neshama, that part of us that we have so much trouble revealing, and we even put it in a bag and put it behind, and it's hiding, and the kids hide it. I don't know where it is. I don't know where my neshama is. By the end of the Seder, hopefully we've done such a good job that Hashem says, here it is. And now we're going to reveal that neshama. That's what Yaakov was saying. That Esav can never destroy. That we have to bring out. That's a very beautiful, beautiful way of looking at the afikoma. This that you break up. That's what the greater half. Now, here is a little bit of a problem coming up. The problem is, you're going to break this matzah in half. The smaller half you will be using as for the mitzvah of eating matzah later on. So that has to have a certain minimum amount. what we call a kezias, a minimum amount. A minimum amount of a kezias is about 25 grams of matzah. So even that smaller part should be 25 grams of matzah, preferably. So, and the larger one more than 25 grams. So you got a little problem. If you ever check out your machine matzahs, your average machine, whole machine matzah is 30 grams. So if you're using a machine matzah, you're breaking a machine matzah into a bigger and smaller one, the smallest small could be 14 grams. It's not really enough for that amount. That's why it's preferred to use a handmade matzah, not because the kasha is any better, but a handmade matzah is bigger. Handmade matzahs run between 50 to 80 grams. So they're 50 to 80, and usually they're more towards the 80 grams size. They're big, you get some big matzahs. So even my smaller part can have 25 grams. My bigger part can have 40, 50 grams. So that's why it's better for the Seder. Now, if you don't have it, you don't have it. You could use machine shmura matzahs. It's okay. And you don't have the 25 grams, and you're going to have to add put a few more grams in from a different matzah. You know, you could do that too. Take another piece of matzah. It's just going to help out over here, be another part of that. But that's why it's better to have a large matzah, so it's able to break up in a good way. Okay, now on the next page. Okay, we did that already. Okay, so that
is... Especially for the children to take that to come in hide when the leader says, no, other person, the leader hides it.
No, in other words, I'm saying the leader hides it, then the kids take it, then they hide it. I'm saying the kids will hide it. But I'm just saying, if you want to keep the kids' motivation, you may hide it first. That's all I'm saying.
No, but I thought that when you are customers, the main is for the Seder leader to hide it.
Yeah, so that's not really the custom. No, it's just evolved to keep the kids more excited. But certainly the children should hide it. So once they find it, now they're keeping it. They hide it somewhere, right? They take it and,
the game starts all over again.
You know, no, they hide it and it's theirs. And now the adult doesn't know where it is. Like the adult doesn't know where it is. And now he has to barter it back from the kid.
Oh, so it's not like the adults go and start looking for this later.
No. It's the kid. The kid now has it. He has it in a good place. He's not going to tell the parent where it is. And the parent says, I'd like Dafikom. And the parent says, okay, what are you going to give me for it? And they have to be reasonable. And that will keep a kid up.
You can't use money on Yontif.
You can't give any money out on Yontif. Certainly not. You can give your own children a gift. Other children, you can give them a gift, but they can't take it till after Yontif. So there's different practical things, and we'll leave that discussion for that Tuesday night class in 2 weeks where we talk about having a marvelous Seder. We'll leave that. That's beyond the halacha. So we'll leave that for another time. Okay, moving on to the next part of the Seder. This is the main part of the Seder now. The main part, Magid, relating the story of the Haggadah. This should take, in a good home, the majority of the Seder. How much time you spend at your Seder, the vast majority should be Magid. Because this is a biblical mitzvah to tell over the story of the Exodus of Egypt on this night. And you have to have that in mind when you're reading it. I'm fulfilling a mitzvah of relating the story of the Exodus from Egypt. And there's three basic ideas you want to convey during this Magid. Number one, the wickedness of the Egyptians and the terrible sufferings they brought to the Jew. Second, the miraculous plagues and the punishments that God did to the Egyptians. And finally, thanks and praise to Hashem for redeeming us and choosing us to be His people. Those are the three themes you want to get through the Seder night. How things were terrible, how Hashem corrected them, and our thanks for that. This is a very important idea. I'll mention it because I just said it in the prayer class this week as well. The Vilna Gaon tells us there are three steps in a person's life of bitachon, of trusting God. This whole Seder is a lesson in bitachon, first of all, you should know. The whole point of the Seder is to teach your children bitachon, trust in Hashem. So if you go through the Seder, you'll see that it goes through the three steps, and I can give all kinds of proofs in the davening. I don't have time for that now. Step one, where you need bitachon, is when things are going bad. When things are going terrible, and you don't see any hope, you have to have bitachon in Hashem. You have to have trust in Hashem. Hashem's going to make things better. Second step is, what about when things are starting to get a little bit better now? Starting to get better. It's the beginning of you getting saved. And there's usually some tool, some means, some messenger who's the messenger to bring the salvation. It could be a doctor. It could be a new person comes into your life. Right? The doctors say you're pregnant, whatever. Oh, it's, you know, you couldn't have children for a long time. The tide is changing. At that point, it's harder to have bitachon in Hashem because you begin to see things are getting better. And usually the rule is, when things are better, we tend to not think of Hashem as much. That's the general rule. We don't have anything, and no, I have no one to turn to but you, God. It's much easier to come to God and pray to God and have trust in God. You know the story of the guy who's late for an appointment, and he's trying to find a parking spot, and he can't find a parking spot. He's praying, God, please give me a parking spot. Please, I need to find, it's important, it's so important. And then as he's saying that, a car pulls out, he says, God, forget it, I found one on my own. Right? So, in other words, God just gave me, no, I got it, I don't need you anymore, thank you. So when things, the doctor has found a cure. You know, all of a sudden, no, that you have to have bitachon then even more so. And then the hardest part is when everything's fine. You've been saved. You're better. Now you gotta thank Hashem. That's also bitachon. And that's exactly what the Seder goes through. We start the first part of the Seder saying how things were terrible. We have to have bitachon that this was for the best. And then you get to the makos and things are beginning to change. Ooh, it's looking better. We have to have bitachon then. And then when we're out, then the Hallel and everything else. Whoa, now I thank you for all that. So we've got to go through those steps of showing our bitachon in Hashem. Right? Now this mitzvah will not be fulfilled if you just read the Haggadah and you don't understand what you're reading. Which is different than davening, for example. When you say the Shemoneh Esrei, if you don't understand what you're saying, but you know how to read the words in Hebrew, it still works to a certain degree. But not at the Seder. If you read the Haggadah and you don't know what you're reading, you have not fulfilled the mitzvah. And therefore, you're not familiar with Hebrew or the Haggadah, that's why you're strongly advised to go over and spend time before the Seder to go over the parts of this Haggadah to know what's important and what am I saying. Even if you don't know what every single word means, but now, okay, this paragraph, I know what it's talking about. You know, the story of, this is the bread of affliction. When we were in Egypt, we had matzah and we didn't have bread and now we're free. Even though you don't know what every word means, but you know the idea. You gotta know that. That's critical. And that makes it into a very deep, meaningful experience. Now, obviously, it's better to read that God in a language than you understand than to read in Hebrew. You don't understand it at all. So quite often when I have certain seders and I have secular people with a seder, I'll read most of the Haggadah in English. My kids always cringe when I do that because they all know Hebrew. Because they got to understand it. We got to say it in English for them to understand it. That is certainly, the blessings you say in Hebrew, but the kiddush you say in Hebrew, but the whole story you say it in English. And again, at that special event for the Seder class, we'll give you lots of ideas about that. Now, also the leader must make sure that everybody understands the essential parts of the Seder. It's not good enough for the leader to know Hebrew. If he reads the whole thing in Hebrew and the kids are just listening like this, there's nothing happening. Now, there's, just like anything, there's a minimum amount. The minimum amount that has to be covered is the plagues and the section that begins from Rabban Gamliel. So in this Haggadah that I have, the Arutz Scroll Haggadah, and this is important, that means that say even wives that are busy preparing food in the kitchen, which they shouldn't be doing anyway, and their husbands should be make sure that they're sitting at the table the whole time. But we know how Jewish mothers and wives are. They want to make sure everything's fine. They got to just go in and double check and this and that, which is fine. But certain times they're not allowed in the kitchen. They have to be at the Seder table. They have to hear what's going on. And that's the plagues, which in my art scroll, it's on page 36. If you give me one of your copies, I can tell you what it is. 16, where you begin.
15.
Dom Eish v'simron Ashon, the bold words. 36 in the art scroll, one, right at the bottom. That's where we begin dealing with the 10 plagues. And that's the next page where we say the 10 plagues and the acronym for the 10 plagues. So that they have to be in for that part. That's an important part. And even more important, the most important, is in the art scroll, page 42. It'll be a few pages after, starting with the words, keep turning, the words Rabban Gamliel. Page 18 in the... No, Rabban Gamliel. Page 21. In the art scroll, it's 42. Rabban Gamliel says, if you didn't say these three things, you have not fulfilled your obligation. Pesach, Matzah, Mor, and the incompany, until the end of the Seder, which is only about two or three pages, you gotta be in for that. And that's a time where, unfortunately, many wives aren't, because they know, we're getting close to the meal. I better get in there and make sure that everything's ready. That's Bedavka, they gotta be in and hearing that. That they must, everybody must be at the table for that part, even more important than the 10 plagues. Because the Rabban Gamliel says, if you haven't talked about it, you haven't fulfilled your mitzvah. And every paragraph after that says, okay, what's Pesach about? And you point to the shank bone. You point to the shank bone and say what, you know, it explains what Pesach is about, Passover. Then you pick up the matzah, the broken matzah. And you pick up the moror. And then you say a few paragraphs till you move into the second cup of wine. You gotta be there for that. That is the critical, critical part. If you haven't done that, you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah of the Seder.
It's about the four kashas.
The four questions are, now listen, everything else should be done, but I'm saying minimum. If you miss this, you're out. You know? Of course, you should have the four questions and everything else, but whatever, the wife has a little baby, the baby's crying. It's a diaper change. I mean, you have to be practical. It's not always possible. Every mother can be at the Seder the whole time. You have kids fighting with each other. Someone's not feeling well. So what's the minimum? What's the minimum? So the minimum, at least, from Rabban Gamliel, you know, and the Makos also should be done, that is what would be appropriate. Okay? Now, everyone can either read the Haggadah or listen to the reader read it. People don't have to read it. If the leader tells the story and reads it out and everyone listens, that's fine. There's only one. The main thing is at least one person is telling the story of the Haggadah and people are listening to the story of the Haggadah. Right? Now there is a custom that everybody, if you're fluent in Hebrew, everybody reads it together. And again, the beauty of this is with the Haggadah is the Haggadah, it's a guideline. It's a guideline saying this is the best educational way to teach the story. Now you can take that and go beyond it. You can expand and you can elaborate and make it more come to life. You could read the paragraph and say, well, what does this mean? You can discuss it a little bit. If you feel it's not age appropriate for you have little children going through all the details, parts of it, you could skip certain parts. If all you have is young children at the Seder or you have disinterested adults and you personally, you could spend 5 hours on this Haggadah, but you know, the kids aren't going to be able to make it. So you have to be wise and to know, well, we could skip this page. Or I'll read through it quickly. And to know what things to focus on, that's appropriate. So and at certain parts you use as many audio visuals as possible. And you go through that Haggadah explains it to you very well. When you say halach ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction, you pick up the matzah. After you say halach ma'anya, you remove the Seder plate with the matzahs. And then when you're finished with it, you bring it back and then you pour the second cup of wine. And then the manishtana is said, and if the youngest kid says the manishtana, and if there is the younger kid, then the wife or someone else says the manishtana, and if they don't know to say that, then the master says the manishtana. Somebody says the manishtana. You put the plate back, and you continue telling the story. Now when you are telling the Haggadah, one should not be reclining. Because the Haggadah, you should sit with respect. Because you're now describing God's miracles. It's not a time to recline. When we eat, drinking the wine, eating the matzah, that's a time to recline. But going out for the, saying the Haggadah, that's unbelievably powerful stuff. You have to be respectful. When you have the 10 plagues, there's 16 occasions to spill the wine. There's 3 words before the 10 plagues, the 10 plagues, and 3 words after the 10 plagues. The custom is to use your index finger to spill out the wine. Or if you have, you don't like putting fingers in your wine, you can tilt the cup so a little bit spills out. And if you took out too much, you can refill it a little bit for that. Okay? Okay. Then, and when we finish all the magid, we make the blessing on the second cup of wine, another bar priya gofen. Now, in the second cup, if you forget to recline, you must drink it again. That's the one of the 4 cups that you don't want to forget the reclining, because you have to drink it again. If you're a man, woman doesn't have to recline. That's why women shouldn't feel bad they don't have to recline. There's one less thing to worry about. The man has to worry that he's done that properly. So we got that far. I'd say that's halfway through our Haggadah. If you want, I know some of you are going away, but we can do part 2 next week. Okay, and between the 2 parts, we should have the whole halachas of the Haggadah done. Okay, good.